As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
You're in Little Steven's Underground Garage with the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today's interview is part two of my conversation with musician, songwriter, and producer Kenny Laguna. In part two, we find out about his moving to the UK to work for The Who, producing the Steve Gibbons Band, producing Bow Wow Wow, as well as meeting and beginning a long and fruitful relationship with Joan Jett as her producer and collaborator. I mentioned Kenny moving to the UK and there working with the Steve Gibbons Band. He produced their biggest hit single, a version of Chuck Berry's Tulane. Let's hear some of the song now, and then I'll be back on the line for part two of our Kenny Laguna Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Tulane and Johnny opened a novelty shop.
So Kenny, picking up where we left off, talking about the Who's manager, and you'd mentioned Pete meeting a bit ago, what got you overseas to work with the Steve Gibbons Band? I mean, they had this hit version with Tulane. How did you get from New York over to the UK?
Well, first we went over to Motown, was called Mo West, with Peter Meaden. And during that trip around 1971 or something like that, it was a disaster because my partners were so drugged out. Peter brought us over. I met Pete Townsend then a little bit, and we met Moon, but nothing great came out of that. And then Peter Meaden went to The Who. He was very troubled. He sold The Who for £500. That could screw you up. And one day he called me and he said he wanted Lieber and Stoller's number, and I knew them, so not well, but I knew them. And I gave them the number. They passed on the project. Then half hour later, I got a call. They wanted Vinnie Poncia's number. So I gave him Vinnie Poncia's number. He's a big deal. But he wrote a lot of number ones like Oh My My and You Make Me Feel Like Dancing and
okay,
a bunch of things. Anyway, so Vinnie passed on the project. And a half hour later, I get a call. And he asked me if I would produce this. He said, they were complaining about, he said, John Entwistle, the world's most uncreative man, which, by the way, is not true, was producing this record, and it's a disaster. We only have about a month, and then the Gibbons Band are going worldwide tour with The Who. We have to have this record, and it's got to be great, and it's not great. Can you come over? Well, I was on the road with Tommy James, and I had to get permission from Tommy, and Tommy would have to cancel a couple of dates. And God help me, I was so lucky that Tommy was willing to do this.
Yeah.
He said, well, maybe you can get, opening slots from The Who. Now, you know, I didn't know The Who well enough to ask for something like that. And I did ask Bill Kirbishley when I got him on the phone, but I didn't know him. And he said, well, we'll talk about that later. But of course that meant, are you crazy?
Yeah.
Why would we let you open for the... But so that's how it started. And then Bill said to me, you know, we'll send you a first-class ticket. Oh, my God. First-class ticket to go over and make a record for The Who's company. So it was Christmas time, I guess 1975 or 6. And I went over there. I didn't sleep for 3 weeks. And I made that first record. And a song called Johnny Cool got on the American charts. So they let me do the next record. The next record we did in one of Pete Townsend's estates. He had about five estates. Everyone had a studio. This one, Goring on Thames, had two studios. One was a separate building. And I stayed at a little bed and breakfast place. Uh-huh. It was so rural in 1975, 76, that if you didn't get your sandwiches out of a pub by 11 o'clock, you did not eat. There was no little fridge or anything in the hotel, no room service, no nothing.
Yeah.
And we're talking about upscale. You're not talking about medium scale. You're talking about, you know, the equivalent of Beverly Hills. But in those days, you know, there was no all-night diners in England, no nothing. And one day we missed dinner. It was very disconcerting.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I'm working in Pete Townsend's estate. And his brother-in-law, who later had a hit, John Astley, was my engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And you would not believe the caliber of people would come by and visit, you know. And there I was, a washed-up bubblegum guy. All of a sudden, I'm in the thick. I remember Keith Harwood was one of the Rolling Stones engineers, very well known at the time. And, you know, he came by and, you know, we met the cream of the crop. So I make this record. The truth was the band had broken up and nobody wanted to tell Bill Kirbishley. So there am I with this band. They have no songs. So I have to, like, put all this together. I don't want to rat them out.
Right.
But yet, it's very touchy situation. I have to deliver an album. You know, and at one point, Ashley goes to his brother-in-law, goes to Pete, and starts complaining that it's taking too long. Well, damn right it's taking long. There are no songs. So I'm like, one time I put together a chorus, and I'm figuring, like, well, really, I should get a songwriter's credit, but it's touchy. You're dealing with the Who, the House of the Who, at the height of their career. You know, everything is very touchy. I lightly approached the subject with Bill. It didn't go over well, so I let that go. And then I brought the song. I, you know, being a Fairy fan, I knew about the song. We tried that. I didn't expect it to be a single, and out of nowhere, when it finally came out, there we were.
Yeah.
Just think it's a fantastic record.
This is...
And, you know, I got to talk to Chuck Berry about it. Chuck Berry. Now, there's a guy. Oh, my God. I'll just tell you two Chuck Berry stories.
Sure.
Before Joan and I. The Joan and I with Chuck is another whole bunch of stories, but because he loved Joan. But in 1968, he had My Ding-a-Ling, and I'm playing with Jay and the Americans. So we're doing a... And they had this magic moment. So whatever period that was, we had current hits. And we're playing Nassau Coliseum, and Marty from Jay and the Americans comes running in. He goes, Kenny, we're going to play with Chuck. They hired a band and they can't play the songs. Because even though Chuck Berry, you're a musician, you know, Chuck Berry, all the songs are three chords, but they happen in different places.
Right.
So, like, if you don't know, you know, that one chord in Old Carol is different than the one chord in Johnny B. Good. It lasts longer or shorter. And if you don't really know them, you can screw it up. So Chuck's all upset because the band they hired does know how to play his shit. So Marty and I, we know every Chuck Berry song, so we're in. And he goes, let's go say hi to Chuck. So Marty and I go to his dressing room, and he's sitting there eating some fried chicken, and we walk in. I'm Marty, this Kenny, we're with Jay and the Americans, and we're going to be backing you tonight. And he looks up and he goes, boys, I'm eating. Can you leave me alone? So we talked about One Inch Tall, and we did not see him again until we were on stage, and that was that time. Then when I met him with Joan, I, you know, get my chest up big, and I says, you know, Chuck, I covered Tulane for The Who, and we had a top 10 record in England, and I believe that's the only hit by that song. Yeah, so... Oh, I should have known. This is a man who wrote rock and roll music that were number one by the Beach Boys and number one by the Beatles. So, okay, you're not impressed, Chuck. I get it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me ask you, here's something that I hadn't realized until I actually had was looking more closely about your career. And you've already touched on it a bit. You mentioned Jonathan Richman, but you did a bunch of stuff with Berserkly Records there towards the tail end of the 70s. How did you get hooked up with Berserkly, and what was it like working with Jonathan Richman?
Well, Tommy James and the Shondells did a show at the Cow Palace. It's a venue in the Bay Area.
Okay.
Pretty legendary for the locals, you know. He got a great review, and Fantasy Records, who had Creedence Clearwater and all dead jazz artists, yeah. Fantasy Records. So they made Tommy a deal, and I went out there to record with Tommy James. And these guys, like, they were in the scene, Earthquake and Berserkly, and there was just a whole scene out there with these clubs. Mm-hmm. Keystone Berkeley and the Keystone Palo Alto. There was a real scene going out there, and everybody who played, Tom Petty, Blondie, The Tubes, anybody who was part of the club scene growing up in that time would pass through, and Berserkley were kind of in the scene, and they were spying all over us, and they mm-hmm. became part of the making of the record. And Joel Selvin, the big writer, he was like a really powerful writer. And they decided I was the man behind the man, which, believe me, I was a part of it. But those other guys, they were, you know, right. Tommy James, he was great. But they decided, and then they started putting little things in the paper. They managed to get me fired from the Shondells, by the way. But they adopted me, and they wanted me to bring the bro building techniques to them out there. And so mm-hmm. I started staying with Greg Kinn in his house and writing songs with him, writing songs with Earthquake. I produced several albums for Jonathan Richmond, one of the greats. He's such a purist that he didn't allow himself to get where he could have gone, but he got pretty good. He was the minstrel in Something About Mary, the hit
right.
movie. And he wrote Roadrunner, which is an amazing song. It was top 10 in Europe. He had a couple of big records in Europe. Greatness. And Greg Kinn had two top 10s, Jeopardy and They Don't Write Them Like That Anymore, the breakup song. And, you know, they were a cultish label, an indie label. Yeah, I had great success with them. So between The Who adopting me, Lever Krebs, the heavy metal giants. I did Beatlemania for them and a few other things. And Berserkly, they saved my career, which was left in ashes by the industry when Bubblegum died.
Mm. About Jonathan Richmond, you mentioned him being a purist, and you're coming from this Bubblegum background, this sort of, you know, you're just cranking out hits. Was it difficult meeting eye to eye with him, or how did you guys get along in the studio?
Well, he and I adored each other, and I was willing to play by his rules. I mean, there was one thing, you know, I'm a pot smoker. He didn't allow any pot smoking, and he's so extreme, very physical guy, always running.
Yeah.
And so one day he goes out for a run, and Matthew and I smoke a joint, and then we sprayed the room with Lysol or something, and he comes back and he smells it. And he goes, "You think you could put deodorant on it and fool me?" He goes, "Now you have to erase the record that you're working on." And I'm like, "Matthew, don't do it. Take it out of record, you know." So he thinks, and Matthew goes, "Nope, he wants to erase it." I go, "You crazy? We've been working on this for a week." And they erased the dang record. And things like that were a little hard to take. But Jonathan recorded a number one record all over the world called Egyptian Reggae. He recorded it in an echo chamber in San Francisco. I mean, mm-hmm. just crazy stuff. But guess what? The record went number one. You know, I could play ball with a purist. Hey, listen, Joan Jett, she's a purist maniac. I mean, you know, and there's a lot of Jonathan Richmond and Joan Jett. So I think I understand it. My mother and father were purists, you know, and they forewent a lot of money in their careers because of art. Right. You know, I sort of get it. But you know, in the 60s when I started, all I wanted to do was, you know, I think Dion is a purist. And I wanted to be that. But if you sold, you know, I would have put a fart on a record if it got me on the radio. you know, I thought, hey, well, I'd do it later. And guess what? I got Joan Jett. I think we made some pretty pure rock and roll records.
I think you did as well. And I want us to talk about Joan here in a moment. But one last thing I want to touch on, I think it's a really cool thing that you did, was working with Bow Wow Wow on that EP, Last of the Mohicans. You'd already started, you know, working with Joan and with Bow Wow Wow. I think it was like 1981. The EP comes out in 82. How did you wind up working with them? And how did you decide that they should cover I Want Candy?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, I actually turned down some things I deeply regret. You know, I was friends with Gary Katz, who produced Steely Dan when he had the hits. He said, I'm just going to stay with Steely Dan and not do anything else. I mean, he later on changed that policy, but I thought it was a pretty good idea. You know, Joey Ramone's a good friend of mine. He kept begging me to produce him. I wish I had, and I didn't, you know. But then they came to me with Bow Wow Wow, and I didn't want to do it. A friend of the family, Steve Leeds, he and I were talking, and we discussed the I Want Candy, and then Joan and a lady in our office, Carol, came in and said, you got to do this thing. And because of that, I said, okay. And RCA paid me really well to do it. Mm-hmm. But I said, one condition is they got to do one song that I bring them. Whatever it is, they got to agree to do one song, because a lot of these bands, and they are great, fantastic, but I believe in a single. So I brought that to them, and we did it, and the record, you know, speaks for itself. I think it's a great record.
Yeah.
It was written by a friend of mine who you mentioned earlier, Richard Goddard, and the great Burt Burns. The way I remember it, we did it from memory, and Richard was working on Vacation with Tom Pannunzio. We called the studio to get to make sure I had it right, and I'd forgotten the da 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 do 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 do. And Richard says to me, "You forgot the guitar bit," and I'm like, "Oh, geez." And we had it all routined, and we had to figure that out over the phone. And anyway, it was wild to be putting together a record like that over the phone. It wasn't like we had the internet, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or it was so obscure. Anyway, I got this record made, and it was big, big record in England, and a huge MTV record. And the band, with the help of Malcolm McLaren, they hate me. They called me a see you next Tuesday in the press, reading this thing. They said I turned them into a bubblegum band. Well, maybe that's why you hired me, whatever it was. So I'd say about 15 years ago, I got a call from Annabella, and she says, I'm in this hotel. Can you come see me? And I walk in. She goes, Kenny, I had it wrong. I want to thank you for I Want Candy. It was the best thing that ever happened. Can we do the follow-up? I think we lost a little momentum. Because, you know, I would have tried to get him record. My boy, lollipop, would have been a great follow-up. You know?
That would have been.
Anyway, you know, they were mad at me because, you know, you got to learn shit. You know what I used to say? You know, John and I sometimes take a little crap because we had some covers. Mind you, she wrote some great songs.
Absolutely.
How's Cherry Bomb? How's Bad Reputation?
Yeah.
You know, how's I Hate Myself for Loving You? I mean, she wrote some good songs. But still, when you look at this, how about the first four Rolling Stones hits were cover songs?
Yeah.
They did okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, let's talk some about Joan now. And when we had spoken before, you and myself and Joan, I think you were talking about some of this, and I want to kind of get it back straight. It was, you were actually dealing with the Steve Gibbons band at the time, but the publicist who worked for whose label was Joan's manager, he wanted you to see the Runaways or meet Joan, something along those lines. Instead, you went to work in California with Berserkly artists, and then the Runaways break up. Joan's manager said they had a movie commitment. Yeah, tell me, what's the story of you becoming aware of her and finally working with her?
Toby Mamus was managing the Runaways and Blondie with a guy named Peter Leeds, and he was doing publicity for the Steve Gibbons band, because that was his main line of work.
Mm-hmm.
And famous Toby Mamus. And with the Runaways, last album was coming up, and he wanted me to produce it, and he kept telling me I'd be great with them. And I had just finished the project, Bill Kerbishley and The Who, and I was in England, and he said, why don't you go up to Amsterdam and meet with the girls, and if they like you, you can produce this record, which was for Polygram, I think, or maybe it wasn't, whatever it was for. So I was staying at the Mayfair Hotel, and I went down to the lobby. I was going to hail a cab, and Matthew Kaufman was checking out, and he goes, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Amsterdam, because you want to ride to the airport. So I said, yeah, that's great. And we're in his Daimler, these beautiful Daimler limousine. And he's saying, so you're interviewing for the Runaway. I says, yeah. He goes, they lost their best player, Cherie Curry, the blonde bombshell lead singer had left. So they've lost their star, and you don't have the job. What if I tell you I'm giving you five jobs? Greg Kinn, Jonathan Richman, Earthquake, the Rubinos, and I have somebody else. And you have the job. You work 5 hours a day. You can smoke all the California weed you want. And I'll put you in a spa. You can stay in a spa, and I'll give you rent a car. And you'll be in California, and it's winter time. You'll be in Amsterdam and England in the winter time, and you don't even know if you're going to get the job. I said, sounds good to me. And he bought me a ticket, and I went to California. Now, if Toby said, you got the job, I would have been committed, and I would have gone to Amsterdam. Yeah. But that's how that happened. So now we're in the middle of the winter, and I'm in California. And my wife, Meryl, flew out. Toby calls me and he says, this is going terrible. The band's breaking up. And John Alcock, the producer, is causing problems. He's taking the band in a heavy metal direction. They're basically going to throw John out of the band. And so Lita Ford and Sandy West have taken over. And they're doing a heavy metal album, which is more John Alcock's bag.
Yeah.
And I still don't come. He wants me to come and take over the record. That sounded terrible. I mean, the last thing you want to do is go into a band that's breaking up.
Right.
I just had one of those with the Gibbons band. But
exactly.
So now the band breaks up. And I hear from him. It's early in the next year. And I hear from Toby again. And he goes, now I'm in England. Jones in California. He said, they got a commitment to a movie company. And they're going to get sued. The only one left is Joan Jett. She doesn't want to get sued. And remember, she's the only one with income. She wrote all the songs. So she's staying behind. You got to do 6 songs in 8 days. And I'm in England. And again, I'm going to turn it down. My wife, Meryl, says, I've been reading about Joan Jett. I look at the pictures. She pops out of the page. I think she's significant. You should go meet her. Go meet Joan. So I fly to California. I meet Joan. First day, she walks into the Hyatt House. Black leather jacket, razor blades hanging down, all kinds of safety pins and craziness. And I'm in love. I said, I've never seen anybody like this. This is great. And we wrote the first song, which is on Bad Reputation, called You Don't Know What You Got. And when she gets the, oh, baby, I go, you know what? I don't know why. But you remind me of Darlene Love. You know how to hang out the way they do in the churches. There's just something about you. Let me help you get a record deal. Little did I know what I was signing up for. I said, all I want to do is I want to produce 2 albums if I get you a record deal. And we couldn't get a record deal. The harder I tried, the more rejection I got. And then I enlist Bill Kirbishley, who has Pete Townsend's My Love Opened the Door on the charts, and Steve Lieber, who has AC/DC and Aerosmith. I mean, I had like the cream of the crop guys saying to people like Atlantic Records, just pay them nothing. Pay them once every 3 months on what you sell. Just do my friends a favor. Nobody would sign Joan. Every other person in the Runaways got a record deal. It was the weirdest thing.
So, why do you think that is? What?
Part of it was imagery. Part of it was there was this resistance that they thought the skinheads represented punks. Part of it is people didn't understand what I always say is the punks were hippies with ugly garb, mm-hmm. tattoos, and piercings. But they were not Nazis. And, you know, there were those skinheads running around with swastikas, but that was a very small minority, and just the imagery. And there was something about Joan's independent womanhood that scared people. But then, you know, the feminists were not crazy about the Runaways.
Yeah.
You know, they thought they were using their sexuality. You know, it depends on how you look at it. You know, it's Christina Blondie said it really good in Joan's doc, that Mick Jagger came out on stage riding a giant penis. What if Deborah Harry or Joan Jett had wrote a giant vagina? They would have got a lot of problems. You know, there was a double standard.
Yeah.
And when the women stuck this, try to say, I own the sexuality. You're not going to fuck me. I'm going to fuck you. That really shook people up. Remember, 2 women never got played together on radio. 2 women were not disc jockeys in a row. That was how rock and roll grew up.
Oh, yeah, I know there's
weird things going on. When we were breaking Hate Myself for Loving You, if they added Paula Abdul, they wouldn't add Joan Jett. If they added Bon Jovi, they wouldn't add Joan Jett because they added a rock record. And I would go, Jesus, it's such a different genre. But, you know, it'd be if they added a rock record, if they added a woman. It was a tough haul.
So you worked up those half dozen songs with her. Then your wife, not only has she alerted you, encouraged you to go work with Joan, but she goes, really all in on Joan because you guys took Joan in and she lived with you for a while, right?
For a long time.
For a long time. How was she as a roommate? Did she act like a rock star at home or did she pick up after herself?
Yes and no. She never acted like a rock star. She is the most humble person on earth. She doesn't consider herself better than anybody, and she's the nicest, anyone will tell you, most down-to-earth human being ever. And that was before she was famous, when she was famous, and, you know, hills and valleys, doesn't matter. She's the nicest down-to-earth person ever. And does she clean up after herself? No. She thinks she's in a hotel no matter where she is.
So we spoke a little bit about, you trying to get her signed and getting the first album out. You wound up financing and doing that yourself, and then it got picked up later, right?
Yes. Luckily, I know all these independent label people. I got a lot of help from them. I got a lot of help from, Mars Levy helped us a lot for no compensation. That was the payback. It's a lot better than royalties. You know, people don't realize, you'll hear a lot of people moaning about, and there are those who have a right to moan. But remember, if you had a three-point deal and you sold a million records, that was $30,000. So let's say there were five guys in the band, and then you pay your taxes. What do you think that is? $4,000? But when it was time, I knew the guy who owns Camelot, because Mars had us meet those people. And I knew, people who worked radio. And I was able to be trusted by them, so I had an account. And when we were on our own, we had people doing a roadmap for us, like Steve Leeds, and we would go to clubs. So if we went to do a show, let's say the Malibu or my father's place, we'd marry that show to WBAB or WLIR, and then WNAW would do a show in Manhattan. And BCN in Boston, and MMR in Philadelphia, and FNX. What about your own kid, Leo?
You're in Cleveland,
he would,
yeah.
Extract blood. He would extract blood. But he supported, it's funny. Leo and Joan have been friends since before I knew Joan. Amazingly, because Leo was a tough ad. It was really hard to get him to play rec, but he played the Runaways. I don't know how he knew. He always knew Joan was a star, that guy.
Yeah.
But, we're talking about, really revolutionary. There were no acts had their own label. We didn't do it because we were smart. We did it because we were desperate. We printed up our own records because that was the only way we could get magazine reviews. And then I printed up a bunch of extra records and hired Steve Leeds and then a bunch of other guys to get us airplay, and miraculously, we were able to get KLOL in Houston and WSH in Florida. I mean, it was unheard of for an independent label, a rock label, to get these mainstream stations.
Yeah. And then the second album, I Love Rock and Roll, that's from 81. That's huge. It sells over 10 million copies. And on there, Joan does a version, the Blackhearts, they do a version of Tommy James and Shondell's Crimson and Clover. So two questions. Did you play on the original, and did you suggest to her that she should cover it?
I recollect playing on the redone version that was the FM version.
Uh-huh.
But the original one, first of all, everybody kind of deserted Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like the Marvin Gaye story that the guy's trying to make his own record. Forget it. How's this guy going to make his own record? And I remember one day he says to me, come here, I want you to hear something. And he played me that record. I nearly fell on the floor. I fell on the floor a couple times in my life. One was when I heard Every Breath You Take. And then the other was Crimson and Clover, the best record ever. And then in my record collection, obviously, I have a big Tommy James collection. And Joan pulled that out and said, oh, I love this song. And she started fooling around with it at a sound check in a club. Uh-huh. And all the people mopping and everything put down their mops and applauded. So that's funny. And then she started doing it at the sound checks. And one day she tried it at a gig, and it went over better than any other song. And before I Love Rock and Roll was a hit, that was the song that got the best reaction. So we always thought, wow, this is interesting. When we put out the record, we thought that was going to be the hit. But I Love Rock and Roll exploded off the record. We didn't even do anything. Neil Bogart was our partner on that record, and he thought Little Drummer Boy was the hit. John and I thought Crimson and Clover was the hit. We were pleasantly surprised.
But you did release it as a single, right?
Yeah, it went to number three.
Yeah, so, I mean, you guys were right, just not in the order that you thought, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we thought I Love Rock and Roll could be a hit, you know? We had no idea it was going to be, like, maybe it was the number one song of the year. I mean, it was big.
I want to ask you here, the band L7 is on Blackheart Records, and their latest single is a version of Fake Friends, you and Joan wrote, and she uses it to kick off that 1983 album called Album. You know, I was DJing that cast party that Drew Carey threw in 2019 for the Price is Right cast, and I saw you guys play. You had a great setup for that song, a great introduction to that song. Can you repeat that story here for us? What inspired Fake Friends?
Oh, let me think. Well, when John and I started, people thought it was very strange, off, for a woman with an electric guitar to lead a band of guys.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of trouble getting a record deal. Now, when we played, people in the industry paid no attention. We started building a following. And somehow, without a label, we had a hit record. And then suddenly, everybody was our friend. And there was just no room in the dressing room because everybody was on our side. And then we went to a cold patch, and we discovered nobody wanted to be our friend. So we wrote a song that became a hit about that phenomenon, and it's called Fake Friends. How'd I do?
You did great. That was a very fun night, by the way. Over the course of the 80s, there are like five Joan Jett albums, and you're producing, you're writing with Joan. So over the course of those five, did you have kind of a rhythm to how you were working together, or was each project unique in how you put things together?
I mean, there's several ways that the song, Joan's a big title person, and she's a big riff person. But, you know, we all do everything. But, you know, it happens various ways, you know, like either of us are capable of doing 90% of a song, and then sometimes we just sit there and grind it out, you know, like Fake Friends. Funny enough, she was writing a song, Fake Friends. I was writing a song, Losing Friends. Both of those are in the hook. We were doing it separately.
Mm-hmm.
And Victim of Circumstance, which went top 10 on the rock chart before being crushed by I Love Rock and Roll. That's a true story. I mean, the Police were waiting in front of her house on San Vicente across from the Whiskey A Go-Go when she woke up. They were waiting. You know, I mean, so, you know, all that in that song is a true story. The Police knew about Joan Jett, and they knew that all the rockers hung out there. Like, there's pictures of Billy Idol in that house. It was a famous house amongst the punk rockers, you know. And there's all different things. Some things are just created, usually my things. Like, I can watch a movie and write, but Joan, like a lot of the writers, she has to experience it to write about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, by the 90s, now Joan is in turn producing artists like Bikini Kill and Circus Lupus. How has your role as a producer evolved over the course of your nearly 40 years together?
She's doing a lot more now.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say there was a time when I did 99%, but she was always there to correct anything she didn't like, which usually is lower the keyboard, lower those doo-wop backgrounds. They're not doo-wop, Joan. Doo-wop is a whole other thing. Get rid of that. It sounds like a Beach Boy part. Make my guitar louder. So You know, I mean, nothing gets released without her approval. But now, you know, she's there. She's got her hand on the board. And, yeah, she's just doing a lot more. And she, you know, she actually records a lot at home, brings it, and we fly it onto the record. And she's writing, she and Dougie write 90% of it now. I'd say it was 50-50 in the beginning.
Yeah, let's talk a moment about your wife, Meryl. You mentioned being a high school sweetheart, and she's the one that really encouraged you to find out more about Joan, check her out. How has your relationship with her changed over the years? Because it seems like as time's gone on, she's been an important confidant, and that role has grown. Or how would you describe it?
Well, the role has grown in, you know, being together for so long, and we don't fight as much as we did in high school. And my daughter, Carrie Ann, runs our business now, and thank God, because she understands it. There's a lot to understand. I mean, do you understand it? The streaming, we don't have physical product like we used to. And then the pandemic, the logistics are getting very, very complicated. Meryl is still a huge consultant. Carrie Ann's running the whole thing. And the challenge during, you know, we're not touring now.
Yeah.
And I guess you understand what that is. I mean.
Oh, absolutely. All right. Yeah.
Carrie Ann has jumped in, and I don't know how she's doing it, but, you know, thank God we own the Masters. We had a sold-out stadium tour that got postponed for a year. And, you know, at first we weren't even going to do the stadium tour. And, you know, we got such nice overtures from the other bands that we got talked into it. And now we're so happy we said yes. And then disappointing about a tour is one thing. Disappointing about the way our country's handling it is, oh, my God.
Let's talk about Carrie Ann here for a moment. You mentioned her, your daughter, running the business, and I know she was in large part responsible for getting the Bad Reputation documentary about Joan to happen. Are there any plans for her to do one about dear old dad? About you?
Oh, I doubt it, but you never know. You know, we're talking to book people, whatever. You know, John and I have both been offered books to write, and we just never did it, but you never say never now. I mean, you know.
That's what I'm saying, buddy. Never say never now. Yeah. This is the time to start working the keys on the instrument, but start working on the computer.
Meryl or Carrie Ann should do a book. Maybe Meryl should do a book. Carrie Ann is involved in film and television. She works with a couple of the major networks and whatever. And let's see what happens. You know, it's a wild time out there with you know, we keep hearing they're going to do it, you know, in Hollywood, and then everybody's running into corona problems.
Right.
Just like, I'll be amazed. I see football uses Joan's song, Waiting All Day for Sunday Night, and I know they're putting it together, but, you know, are they going to be able to do football this year? I mean, that's a pretty close encounters.
Well, I will tell you, Kenny, as a joke, I was referring to 2020 as a lost year, like a month or two ago, and now I'm certain it is a lost year, and I don't think there's going to be any improvement until there's a new administration. But I guess let me get back here on target for a second. I wanted to ask you, what's the last artist you've produced that's not Joan Jett?
Well, I had a tiny hand with Joan on the L7 one.
Oh, okay.
Produced by Norm Block. He's very talented, but they did send us the thing. So I had a little tiny hand in that. And then the other thing, which I'm proud of, that with a fellow named Di Stefano, we produced Carrie Underwood's Waiting All Day for Sunday Night last year. So picture the guy who did all that bubblegum with Carrie Underwood on the number one show on television. So that was last year. But other than Joan, I don't think I've done much last year.
Yeah. Well, I have just a couple of other questions here. I mean, one is, this has kind of come out as we're talking, you know, the music business, not known for loyalties. You're in Joan's relationship, a big exception. How important is the notion of loyalty to you?
Well, it's been good for me in my career. I'm proud to say I'm still friends with, like I told you, I met Tony Orlando when I was about 14. Mm-hmm. And I just spoke to him about it a week ago. I'm friends with Vinny Poncio, I mentioned earlier. I think it's really important. I'm still friends with Tommy James. Yeah, and Jonah and I don't know how it was, but we love each other just like we did when we met. And and Joan and my wife, Meryl, and Carrie Ann speak every day. It's a wonderful thing to be loyal to each other. I don't know how I was so lucky, but there you go. I mean, Darlene Love and I, you know, I know it since I'm 16. It's terrific to be like that. And I like to think I've handled myself with honor. I'm sure there's a few people who don't love me, but I try to be honest, and it's important.
Well, Kenny, when we spoke around the beginning of 2019 with Joan, you were talking about how in the late 1960s, it was totally accepted that your music career couldn't go past the age of 30. By 30 years old, you'd be washed up. You've been living the gravy for a long while, haven't you?
Yeah, unbelievable.
And what do you attribute that to?
Well, part of it is the war babies, which I am one of, grew up and maintained buying power. And the rest of it is I never stopped working. I mean, I probably never took off more than a week in my whole career. So that was important, too. You know, some of the really talented people took off for 10 years here there. You know, like Pat Benatar went away for a while to raise children and,
yeah,
you know, got unjustly forgotten. I mean, she's worked her way back, but, you know, just things like that. But the rest of it, you know, first of all, hitching my wagon to a superstar like Joan, that helps. And maybe I was pretty good at the craft that I picked, you know, that helped too.
Yeah. Kenny, thank you so much for taking all this time to talk with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
And good luck to you too, buddy. I'll be listening to you.
I saw him dancing there by the record machine. I knew he must have been about 17. He was going strong, playing my favorite song. And I could tell it wouldn't be long that he was with me, yeah, me. And I could tell it wouldn't be long that he was with me, yeah, me. Singing,
I love rock and roll. That's Joan Jett with the Blackhearts, doing the title track to her second full-length studio album. This is the Mighty Manfred, and that track was produced by Kenny Laguna. And thanks again to Kenny for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast, both parts 1 and 2. And join us again next week for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.